Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruto. On today's show, Dan Hoos is here from Sullivan County Government with news from Monticello, including a scam targeting HEAP recipients. Officials warn that text messages with links to, quote, save on utility bills are not legitimate. We'll find out more and what to do. A powerful blend of movement, music, and emotion takes center stage at Catskill Art Space's Celebration of Pride with Intimacy Creates. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to founder Sarah East Johnson about her feminist acrobatic dance company, Lava. Plus a preview of Curtain Call, our new theater podcast. And we're also awaiting word from the Supreme Court set to issue the remaining six opinions of its term this hour, including a decision in the case raised by the executive order to end birthright citizenship. We'll bring you special coverage. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Members of Congress remain split on the Pentagon's latest assessment of the U.S. airstrikes against Iranian nuclear facilities. The Pentagon on Thursday released additional details of the attack, calling the operation highly successful. But lawmakers from both parties say they still have major questions. Speaking to NPR's Morning Edition, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine said he's skeptical over the extent of the damage to Iran's nuclear sites.
If the president on Saturday night had said, we have taken this action and we've caused severe and significant damage to the Iranian nuclear program, you wouldn't have seen all this damage control over the damage for the last few days. The president overstated it in all likelihood.
Republican senators, including Ron Johnson and Lindsey Graham, say they fully back President Trump's decision to launch the airstrikes. The Trump administration says it will start funding a controversial aid program in Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the U.S. argues the new system will prevent Hamas from benefiting from international assistance.
State Department spokesman Tommy Pigott says the administration has approved $30 million in funding for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which he says is a creative solution to the hunger crisis in Gaza.
We want to see aid reach the people of Gaza. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has delivered 46 million meals. We've seen that. We want to see that food being delivered.
The UN has described the new distribution sites as death traps as Palestinians come under fire while trying to approach them. Israel has paused almost all other aid into Gaza. Asked if the U.S. is pushing Israel to reopen aid routes, Pigott said the U.S. wants other countries to fund this new operation. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Stocks opened higher on Wall Street this morning as the Commerce Department reported a slowdown in consumer spending last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose by 313 points in early trading.
Cautious consumers dialed back their spending in May. A report from the Commerce Department shows personal spending fell by 0.1% last month. Spending on goods dropped 0.8%, while spending on services was slightly higher. Consumer prices in May were up 2.3% from a year ago, according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. Stripping out volatile food and energy prices, core inflation was 2.7% for the 12 months ending in May. That's slightly higher than forecasters had expected. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, down in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul, but up in Tokyo. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 309 points. This is NPR. A heat wave is starting to ease in large parts of the U.S. Forecasters say a cold front is moving through parts of the Midwest and Northeast today, bringing temperatures down from the triple digits. Cities like Chicago and New York are seeing the first signs of a cool down, though parts of the South remain under excessive heat warnings and advisories. The U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, has announced she's leaving her post. Over her 2.5-year tenure in Russia, Tracy was a groundbreaking diplomat who served in challenging times. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
Kathleen Tracy was appointed to the Russian ambassador post under the Biden administration, the first woman to ever hold the Moscow job. A career diplomat specializing in the former Soviet Union and a fluent Russian speaker, her tenure coincided with a cratering of U.S.-Russian relations over the Kremlin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and the U.S.-led sanctions that followed. Yet in interviews with the Russian press, Tracy routinely emphasized that the U.S.'s differences lay with the Russian government, not the Russian people. In her farewell announcement, she paid tribute to the many proud Russians she'd met working for a better future. The Trump administration's choice for her successor has not yet been named. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
President Trump says the U.S. and China have signed a trade agreement which formalizes a temporary deal they had already reached in May. It's unclear if the deal was different from the one Trump announced 2 weeks ago. China's Commerce Ministry described the two countries as having confirmed additional details of a framework for a trade agreement. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We have an important decision today from the United States Supreme Court, which is issuing decisions on the last day of its term. This is a decision in a case involving birthright citizenship, the 14th Amendment right of a person born in the United States to be a citizen of the United States. The Trump administration had challenged that right, had been pushed back in court, and appealed one aspect of it to the United States Supreme Court, which has now issued its ruling. We're all still reading in the team that you're going to hear from, but I'm going to tell you one of the findings. And this involves not specifically birthright citizenship itself, but rather the way in which the administration was barred from enforcing an executive order that would limit birthright citizenship. A number of courts issued nationwide injunctions against the Trump administration. District courts, which have jurisdiction in a portion of the United States, issued nationwide injunctions against the administration. And the administration, having lost in the merits in those cases, challenged the right of those courts to issue nationwide injunctions. Now the Supreme Court has taken this case on an expedited basis, and the finding is out, the ruling is out. This is from the judgment held. Universal injunctions likely exceed the equitable authority that Congress has given to federal courts. The court grants the government's applications for a partial stay of injunctions entered here. And so the Supreme Court has said that district courts have exceeded their authority, likely exceeded their authority, in blocking the actions of the Trump administration in this executive order. We're going to hear a number of voices about this, about the politics. NPR's Domenico Montanaro is here. We'll hear from NPR's Nina Totenberg, of course, shortly. And we're going to begin with NPR Justice Correspondent Kerry Johnson, who is in our studios here, Studio 31. Kerry, it's good to see you. Good morning.
Thanks. Good morning, Steve.
This strikes me as a significant decision because there have been so many nationwide injunctions.
Yes, there have been a record number of nationwide injunctions this year. The Trump administration has really railed against that and has said that these lower court judges are exceeding their authority. In part, the conservative supermajority of the Supreme Court appears to have agreed this morning in a 6-3 opinion. We're still going through it. But the court has granted Trump's request to narrow injunctions against his birthright citizenship executive order, which, of course, he signed on his very first day in office this year.
I want to work through some of the background here. First, nationwide injunctions. They're not something that was invented this year, right? This is something that has happened for a while.
This has been bedeviling presidents of both political parties for the last 20 or 30 years. I heard President Obama rail against it, certainly President Trump in his first term, and former President Joe Biden did too. Because when Congress is not doing very much, Steve, presidents are forced, in their view, to take executive actions to accomplish some of their policy agenda. And this practice of nationwide injunctions has allowed people to challenge some of those presidential actions and allowed courts to block them, at least temporarily.
Okay, so presidents of both parties were unhappy about this. I'm having a memory of judges in Texas ruling nationwide against aspects of Obamacare, for example. But it's become especially controversial this year because, in the view of multiple district court judges, the Trump administration has wildly exceeded its constitutional authority again and again and again on issue after issue and has faced, I believe, a record number of nationwide injunctions against it. Is that fair to say?
Dozens and dozens. The Solicitor General, John Sauer, talked about that and talked about how it's basically perverting the ability of the executive branch to do what it needs to do and what it believes it was elected to do in the U.S.
And this became, I don't want to say solely a talking point, but definitely a talking point on the right among Republicans, that this is judges exceeding their authority, and it's an idea that the Supreme Court then took up and considered here.
Interestingly enough, lower court judges appointed by presidents from both political parties have moved to block some of President Trump's moves this year. The Supreme Court majority appears to have been a little bit frustrated with that, at least in its opinion today. And interestingly enough, you know, the court today did not opine about whether this birthright citizenship executive order itself was unconstitutional, but it's making a decision based on the procedure and how lower court judges have been acting generally.
Two things to follow up on there. First, you said a 6-3 ruling. We know that it's a 6-3 supermajority. Did it go along the ideological lines? It's the conservatives against the liberals here?
It absolutely did. The dissents we're seeing are from Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson.
And second, you just said a very important thing, because as I'm reading this, the initial read of the case, it appears to say that the Supreme Court overturns the nationwide injunction to the extent that it may exceed a court's authority, which sounds like the court ruling stays in place. Birthright citizenship is, in fact, the rule, and the Trump administration is, in fact, blocked, but perhaps only in the district of the judge who made the particular ruling. Is that how you see this?
We're still teasing it out right now, and it's a little bit nuanced, Steve, as to the practical implications. But we did hear in the oral argument attorneys for the states involved talk about how that if this birthright citizenship order were allowed to go into effect, it would mess up entitlement programs in states and the entire systems by which babies are recognized, the birth certificate process, and eligibility for state and federal insurance programs and the like. So it's quite a serious set of consequences for people.
Okay. And there's an additional detail. I'm being sent details. Multiple people are reading this decision all at once. Our Washington editor, Krishnadev Kalamur, is part of our team, and he finds this line. His eye falls on this line. The principal dissent's analysis of the executive order. So we're getting into the dissent now. Says that this is premature. Wait a minute. Let's try to understand this. Essentially, it's saying this has nothing to do with birthright citizenship. They do not rule on the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of limiting birthright citizenship. That's what this says.
Yes, the court is not deciding today on the legality of the birthright citizenship executive order in and of itself. This decision concerns the power of lower courts to block parts of President Trump's agenda and the considerations under which they can do so.
Okay, Carrie Johnson, stay with us. I want to bring other voices now into the conversation. We've just been reading of this Supreme Court ruling that appears to leave alone for the moment the question of birthright citizenship and whether the Trump administration can limit it. But it does limit the power of district court judges to block the administration. NPR's Domenico Montanaro covers politics, and he's on the line. Domenico, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's important, number one, to figure out just how much the Supreme Court says that the lower courts are able to slow things down within the administration. But it's clearly the court's conservatives are sending the message here that they think that the right of the lower courts is not to block what the executive branch wants to do. And, you know, you could really argue that this second Trump term has really been about Trump trying to test the limits and get rid of obstacles. And the courts have been the one of the last things sort of standing in the way of a number of things that Trump wants to do. This could open the floodgates for Trump to be able to go forward with any number of things that he wants to do, you know, whether it's, you know, these very broad sweeping executive orders that we've seen, you know, that have really tested the limits to anything else that really the Trump administration wants to try and do. And I think we're seeing this second term now sort of test the limits for what the separation of powers are exactly. And if there's one thing that the Supreme Court has, you know, at least some feeling of jurisdiction over, it's the courts. And it clearly is sort of sidestepping this issue of birthright citizenship, which was the sort of key part, the crux of this case in the first place. But now this could actually mean that the Trump administration, you can sort of grease the wheels on a lot of the things that it wants to do. And that we know that they've certainly wanted to do a lot of broad measures.
Well, here's one of our questions, or one of everyone's questions now, is how will this apply to many, many cases across the country? And let's bring in yet another voice to discuss that. Amanda Frost is a legal scholar at the University of Virginia. She followed the oral arguments on this case and is now with us reading in the decision. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So how sweeping do you think this decision is in its effects?
Yeah, I think this is fairly momentous. Not because it addresses the substance of the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order, it doesn't do that, but because it addresses this question of universal or nationwide injunctions, which are an essential tool for those challenging lawless executive action or executive action they think exceeds executive power. And as a result of this decision, now while individual plaintiffs could win relief, each and every person affected would have to sue in order to get relief. And in other words, an administration that's violating the law could lose a case and yet nonetheless apply the policy across the nation.
I want to tease that out for a moment, Amanda, and make sure that I understand what you're telling me. Say the administration in this instance denies citizenship to 1,000 people who were born in the United States. One of them sues, and the judge says, well, that was ridiculous. You obviously have a constitutional right to citizenship. Your citizenship remains the same. The other 999 still have their citizenship denied unless they individually sue?
Yes. And the problem there is, of course, it's going to overwhelm the lower courts. It's going to lead to extraordinary expense and chaos and harm to the individuals involved. At the oral argument, Solicitor General Sauer was asked by Justice Gorsuch, what's your plan for implementing this executive order in 30 days if we rule in your favor? And he said, well, we're going to work on that. He didn't have one. So I predict it will be very difficult for the government, but of course for the 999 people who didn't file suit, who have expecting babies and don't know if their children will be citizens.
I was following some of the oral arguments, though, and I want to ask about an aspect of this. Wasn't there discussion of a kind of lawsuit that people will be familiar with, a class action suit, where one person or 10 people file, but they say, we're doing this on behalf of a whole class of people? Couldn't that be an answer here?
Yes, and I think that is a partial answer and will undoubtedly be what plaintiffs' lawyers do in the future, seek to have more classes certified. But class actions cannot be certified in every case. Some cases don't qualify. The Supreme Court's prior precedents have limited the availability of class actions, so they're not a form of relief in every case. I do want to add, though, that the court did leave on remand for the lower courts to decide the question of what kind of relief the states as parties would need. So states sued as well as individuals, and states said we need broader relief than just for the residents of our state because people move across state borders. And the court did recognize that was a problem, and so that remains to be decided by the lower court.
Wow, I'm now trying to figure this out. Someone might be denied citizenship in Texas, and they move to California, and they're a citizen now, and then they move to Wyoming, and they're not a citizen. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm explaining, and in fact, what the Solicitor General of New Jersey told the Supreme Court at oral argument, and the Supreme Court clearly listened because it did remand that piece of the case.
It did remand that piece of the case. So some of this, it's very complicated. Some of this is not decided. We just don't know how it's going to.
Yes, and I should add, I have yet to read all 119 pages of the opinion at 10:15 in the morning. So, but that's my takeaway for at this point.
I want to ask about, there's going to be clearly some skepticism about this, and I have a couple of questions about that. And the first is the timing. As Kerry Johnson astutely pointed out, presidents of both parties have been frustrated by these nationwide injunctions, these universal injunctions. But some people, I'm not here to criticize motives because I don't think that's fair. You got to build on evidence. But some people will raise the question and notice that the conservative supermajority decided to act on this problem just as it was interfering with the president from their party.
Yeah, I won't comment on motives either. I will say that it's always, the executive branch is never going to like universal injunctions, because they're all, whoever is in power, whether it be a Democrat or Republican, a universal injunction stops them from implementing their policies. So the executive branch as a branch always has an interest in limiting them. I would like to think courts might have realized that it's actually in their branch's interest to have some form of collective relief, because the other thing that's going to happen is a flood of lawsuits, as each and every individual affected will file suit if they don't qualify for a class action.
Is that going to reduce the effectiveness of the courts? Aside from reducing the power of an individual district judge, does this make the entire court system less effective in responding to an executive that seems to go beyond its power?
Yes, I think it's limiting or minimizing the role of courts in checking executive power. This is another decision that expands executive power. And right now that's benefiting a Republican president. In the future, it could benefit a Democratic president. But it's at the expense of the legislative branch, whose laws might be being violated, and the judicial branch, which is supposed to keep the executive in check.
I want to read a quote from one of the dissents, and then we're going to go to Carrie Johnson, who is still with us. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor, one of the three liberals who dissented from this ruling. And the quote gets to what's going on here, what she thinks is going on here. The gamesmanship in this request is apparent, and the government makes no attempt to hide it, yet shamefully this court plays along. She is pretty clearly questioning the motives of her fellow justices there, I think.
Yes, and obviously these three dissenters, three have been dissenting in a number of cases, and giving full-throated critiques to their colleagues here in the dissent.
Carrie Johnson has continued reading while we've been talking. What more are you discovering, Carrie Johnson?
Yes, another bit from the dissent from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She says the court's decision to permit the executive branch to violate the Constitution with respect to anyone who has not yet sued is an existential threat to the rule of law. She's pointing out, in her view, the problem that everyone would have to go to court individually and sue, or band together in some kind of class action to accomplish some relief from some of these executive orders. And in her view, that is a disaster for the courts and the rule of law, too.
Amanda, I want to try to expand this out. I'm testing your memory here a little bit, because there have been so many dozens and dozens of nationwide injunctions. But off the top of your head, what are some of the things besides birthright citizenship where this might have immediate effect?
Oh, you mean in this current administration? Because
yeah.
I was going to say that there are plenty of examples of nationwide injunctions against President Obama and President Biden's policies.
Things that are active live issues right now with the Trump administration.
Yes. Yeah, so there are broad injunctions in place in a number of different immigration-related cases. So cases involving the Alien Enemies Act. I believe there are injunctions in place challenging some of the executive branch's attempts to defund various federal programs. So these are all examples of nationwide injunctions that have been used to curb executive branch policies, particularly ones issued through executive order, where we have a president unilaterally making changes, and that was true under Biden and Obama as well.
Have you been surprised by the extent to which the court has deferred to the executive here? Not as much as the Trump administration has wanted. The court has ruled against the administration on a number of occasions, but nevertheless, the administration has pushed the boundaries here successfully a number of times.
I'm not surprised, or certainly not shocked, because many of these justices worked in the executive branch. They tend to favor the executive branch in their rulings. And this is not the first time they've issued a decision that gives the executive branch more leeway than might have been predicted or might have been viewed as the doctrinally correct solution. So I'm not shocked. This is a pro-executive branch court.
Carrie Johnson is also thinking about how this might affect other cases and other controversies.
Yeah, the import of the court's majority ruling today is that many more people are going to have to take their cases to court individually. And it comes at a time when President Trump and the White House have been targeting major law firms with executive orders. And some of the firms have agreed to do pro bono work that would support the Trump administration and its priorities. And so The idea that there could be limits on pro bono work at the same time that the Supreme Court is saying many more people have to go to court, many more people who are vulnerable and maybe don't have a lot of resources or low income, this could put further strain on the legal system, which is already under enormous strain this year with hundreds of cases challenging Trump and what he's done so far.
I'm also thinking about, from a practical sense, this underlines the power of the government and further empowers the government, which if you're in favor of the administration, you're going to like. And if you're not in favor of the administration or worried about the long-term effects, you might not. When we talked about that case where 1,000 people have to sue individually, the government, the administration, for free, on our taxpayers' dime, really, can work all of those cases, can assign lawyers to all of those cases. But on the side of the plaintiffs, the people who would sue the administration, they have to go and find 1,000 lawyers to work for them.
Yeah. And now many of the major law firms around the country who have been doing a great deal of pro bono work have basically signed deals with the Trump administration to limit or cabin the parameters of the sort of work that they might do. The other thing, Steve, which is a trend we've been seeing across the Supreme Court over time, is giving more power to the executive branch and giving more power to themselves. Today, this high court majority took away power or limited power from district judges and appeals court judges and gave more power to the high court itself.
Let's get a little bit more of the political context from Domenico Montanaro, who is still with us. Domenico, this is fundamentally, I mean, we've ended up in this rather rarefied place of discussing the exact power of district judges, but this was a case about a visceral issue, American citizenship, part of this broader issue of immigration. What is the context of that? How popular has the president's approach to immigration been up to now?
Yeah, it's gotten less popular, frankly. I mean, it had been one of the more popular things that he had been doing at the start of his administration. You would see people, relatively high saying, 54% saying that they approved of his handling of immigration. But as these sort of cases of more extreme examples of deportations or masked arrests with unnamed or unmarked, unidentified law enforcement officers, pulling people off the streets, that has seemed to sort of dampen down what have been people's feelings about how Trump is handling these deportations, because there's a spectrum. People are very much in favor of deporting hardened criminals, but not as much, the landscaper or the Home Depot worker without a criminal record. The other thing here, in thinking more directly about this case when it comes to public opinion, we've seen people feel that given how much the Trump administration has tried to do, there was an AP NORC survey, for example, last month that found that 57% of people felt that Trump had gone too far in using presidential power to achieve his goals. Only 32% said that they thought that Trump had been about right in how much power that he decided to use. So you already have Trump sort of swimming upstream a bit with his base, certainly well intact, thinking that he's doing the right things, but independents and Democrats largely feeling he's gone too far. And I can only think that this ruling will empower Trump to feel that he can go even further.
Amanda Frost, I want to ask about something that seems a little bit abstract, but seems significant. There was a concern during oral arguments that the following thing would happen. The administration gets sued in district court. They lose because they obviously deserve to lose on whatever the issue is. In theory, that should be appealed up to the Supreme Court and become a nationwide judgment. But the administration just never bothers to appeal the decision they lose. And so they have only lost the one case, and then they win the other 999 by default. Does this ruling appear to do anything about that concern or close the door to that?
Not that I can see. And that was the line of questioning by Justice Elena Kagan, where she pointed out that if an executive branch wants to avoid having their even clearly unconstitutional executive order be stayed or stopped by courts, all it has to do is refuse to appeal a loss to the Supreme Court of the United States. And unless and until they do take that appeal, they will literally win by losing. They could lose every single case in a district court, never take an appeal, and continue to apply the policy to everyone without the wherewithal to sue. Class actions might be a solution, but they are not available in every case.
Carrie Johnson, you get the last word.
the administration and Solicitor General John Sauer told the Supreme Court during oral argument in this case that the administration would respect the judgments and opinions of the Supreme Court. It's held out some questions about the lower courts. And now we're going to find out if the administration actually is going to do what John Sauer said it was going to do. The Supreme Court is the final word, but it's an open question how long it may take and in what form some of these legal challenges to Trump's executive orders and other policies will get there.
So counting on the good faith of the Trump administration, and also because decisions last, counting on the good faith of whoever might be president next, I suppose. Okay, that's the ruling. Universal injunctions likely exceed the authority of district courts, according to the United States Supreme Court. There'll be much more to discuss about this on NPR News. Thanks to everybody who joined us, NPR's Kerry Johnson, Domenico Montanaro, and University of Virginia Law Professor Amanda Frost. I'm Steve Inskeep. You've been listening to live special coverage from NPR News, and we're going to have more coverage throughout the day, including on All Things Considered, and you can find us at npr.org or on the app. This is NPR News.
And you've been listening to NPR News special coverage on Radio Catskill. We're going to resume normal programming now, which is Radio Chatskill at this hour. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Joining us on a Friday, as usual. A little delay there. It's Dan Hoost, though, from Sullivan County Government. Hello. Thanks for standing by.
Oh, not a problem. I got to catch up on emails and chit-chat with you a little bit, so it was fun.
Let's go through some of the stuff that's making news in Monticello. First, how did the primary elections go this week, and how many folks came through in Sullivan County?
Yeah, I think it went pretty smoothly. Kudos to our Board of Elections. We had around 6,000 Republicans and Democrats, mostly Republicans because there were countywide that races with that, participating. And that's not counting the absentee ballots, which I don't have a final number on yet, but the results are pretty clear, I think, in most of the races. The big one, of course, was the sheriff's primary race for the Republican line on this fall's ballot. And, of course, the incumbent Mike Schiff won that over his challenger Tim Diamond. And I think that's one of the main reasons that we saw so much turnout. Board of Elections, I don't know if they think it's a great turnout. I think it's a pretty good turnout considering how many people how many races were going on, and most of the races actually were town committee people for political committees.
So, and
I certainly saw a lot of people take advantage of early voting, which we encouraged, especially since primary day was so dang hot.
Let's talk about the New York State Child Care Assistance Program. Now, they're going to stop accepting new participants and recertifications of current recipients as of July 1st. What's going on there?
You want to say that three times fast?
We don't have time.
Okay. It was the state's been very generous in expanding this benefit, but that also means that a lot more people have signed up for it, which means that basically there's not enough money. Insufficient funds were added to this year's state budget. So our Department of Social Services, just like every other county across the state, has been forced to start denying applications simply due to a lack of funds. The July 1st start of denials will not impact recipients, the current recipients, until they reach their 12-month recert time, as we have enough funding program to support current recipients. But it's basically going to go away, and this is not a good thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about something else that's not so great, a scam targeting folks who receive home energy assistance or HEAP. What's the scam, and what should folks do, really, if they get this text?
Yeah, we've had several recipients that got texts with their name on it saying, it's time to renew your HEAP application so that you can reduce your NYSEG bills. Click here and apply. No such thing. HEAP doesn't work that way. HEAP is an actual benefit that is provided directly to the your home heating energy supplier. Yeah, it could reduce your NYSEG bills, but you have to apply through the state. You don't apply by some text where you click a link that we don't even know where it's going to. So replying in any way, including where it says reply stop to opt out, the scammers are counting on that, because then that means they've got a live one, and then they can sell that phone number that they texted to other scammers and say, hey, this one is working and there's somebody on the other end, so just deluge them with it. So don't respond in any way to it. Delete it. If you have any questions about your HEAP benefits or what you might be eligible to apply for, call our office directly. That's 845-807-0142, 807-0142. You will speak to a real person who is really, truly interested in helping you.
Got a notification that there was a raccoon in Calicoon that tested positive for rabies. What's going on in terms of trying to mitigate that and let folks know how they can help their pets?
Yep. I can't help but say Calicoon raccoon. Right. I just have to. But it was a serious issue, and the raccoon is deceased. It was tested. It tested positive for rabies. It's just a reminder that rabies is in the woods all around us. You need to keep your pets, especially if they're outdoor pets, up to date on their rabies vaccination. And our next one that is currently scheduled will be August 14th at Hanafee Park in Liberty from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Free to all Sullivan County residents. You can bring your dog, your cat, or your ferret. We may have one earlier than that in the Calicoon area. We're trying to put that together.
There's a notary public test coming up later this summer as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. August 20th, we are going to do tests for those who want to become a notary public. So you actually need a license certification. I'm not sure what the proper terminology is, but you can sign up for that by either emailing notaryexam@sullivanny.gov or calling our clerk's office, county clerk's office, at 845-807-0429. You want to do it right away because this test always fills up very quickly.
And showing that we serve all aspects of the community, there is a special event for cranky seniors coming up. Mm-hmm. What is this?
The Historical Society has a number of local performers in their senior citizen years who are going to be doing a performance of Cranky Seniors Are Loose Again inside the County Museum this Sunday, June 29th at 2 p.m. over in Hurleyville. It's a free program. You'll have a great time no matter what age you are, because these are cranky seniors misbehaving in a way only seniors can. We think only kids can misbehave. No. So go have a listen. These are local people that you'll know. You'll be hollering with laughter. It's going to be a good time.
And we have a condensed version of our conversation with Dan Hoos today because of that breaking news we heard earlier. But we have reserved time for this, as we should and must. We have to congratulate county employee Camille O'Brien for winning a hot dog eating contest in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And not just any hot dog eating contest. This is the famous one, right?
She's now going to the famous one at Coney Island.
Yeah.
On July 4th. But it's part of that contest, or that competition. She won it. She ate 8.5 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
I was hungry for lunch, but not now. She is really into this. She's done this before, and she may have a good chance of winning on July 4th, or at least coming in the top five. We're cheering her on. Hopefully she doesn't get too nauseous with it all, but she'll be back to help co-chair our drug task force and do some other things afterwards, after she's recovered from that.
We'll be following that as well. I saw on her Facebook post, too, that she's practicing it. She was doing a practice competition at the Jeffersonville Firehouse with one of the firefighters.
Yes. And probably doesn't ever care to eat hot dogs ever again. But hey, go for it.
Congratulations, Camille. All right. And speaking of July 4th, county office is closed then.
Yes, and we also won't have legislature meetings on Thursday the 3rd. We will have the first set of them the following Thursday on the 10th.
All right, so we will not see you for the holiday, but we'll see you in a couple weeks. Dan Hoos, spokesperson for communications director for Sullivan County Government. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Now, this week on Curtain Call, our podcast about theater, we're spotlighting the North American Cultural Laboratory, or NACL, that hidden gem in Highland Lake, where theater becomes an act of transformation. Tom Candela, the host and producer of Curtain Call, speaks with Executive Artistic Director Brad Krumholtz about residencies, rituals, and performances that challenge the norm and build community through their bold experimentation. Plus, Tom heads to the River Rep Theater in a new segment he's calling Roving Thespian for a behind-the-scenes look at the never-ending story. Here's Tom.
Today, I'm honored to have Brad Krumholtz, the visionary co-founder and executive artistic director of the North American Cultural Laboratory, also known as NACL. NACL is more than just a performance venue. It's a haven for artistic exploration, innovation, and community engagement. Brad, I want to welcome to Curtain Call.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I mean, you have a lot of different programs going on, and you are a haven of growth, I think, for our community. There's always something going on there.
Yeah, it's true. We're a small staff, but small but mighty. It's me, it's Brett Kaiser, it's Lindsay Anderson, who's our director of artist experience. We have a technical associate that works with us named Brendan Regenball. We have a bookkeeper named Jerry Finn, and we have a chef. And the chef is, at this moment, is a contracted employee named Bonnie Matthews. And we're just doing everything we can to support the arts ecosystem. I started focusing more and more to open up our space as a place where people could come and develop their own work. And so now what our primary activity is, and has been for a few years now, is this program, which we call the Deep Space Performance Residency Program.
Yeah.
And that program operates pretty much once every third week. Mm-hmm. We have a company of theater creators come up and live in the house for a week. And we take care of everything for them. And we give them 24/7 access to our theater space and all the technical equipment in it. That week is a rare opportunity for the artists to do nothing but focus mm-hmm. on being artists. And so what we provide is just a week of, we refer to ourselves as a haven. Mm-hmm. It's a sanctified week in which they just get to be the artists that they want to be full time. And they don't even have to think about where they're getting their food from.
And so it has, the L part of it has laboratory in it. And so that connotates experimentation. And how does that fit into what happens there?
It started with this kind of theater work that we were interested in, which at its heart or at its foundation, there was a daily training practice that we would do. So every morning for years and years, we would, with whatever actors we were gathered with, we would go into the studio and we would have hours of physical, vocal, and creative training that are really quite rigorous and exhausting. Mm-hmm. All of those things are part and parcel of the actor's organism. And what the training does is it allows the actor to develop skills that are more like training the actor's organism to be more receptive to the possibility of expressive behavior, so that when an actor encounters a role or encounters any kind of performance circumstance, they become more and more able to absorb the needs of that role and turn them into some kind of expressive performance behavior. And so that's the kind of training that we were talking about. And so that was a lot, that was part of our exploration. And the other part of the laboratory was the fact that we would create our performances really from scratch. And so we're not just developing individual actors' abilities, but we're developing the abilities of people who are creating things together to be able to create things together more fluidly. At the end of each week, we open the doors to a public sharing. And we want to share with them what's going on here because it's important to us to connect with our community in that way. How can the presence of these people help you in your process wherever you are at this moment? And so they don't feel the pressure all week to create something to present to the audience, which is really important. And we really try and communicate to our audience, that's what we are doing, that it is not, we're not consuming a product. We are sharing a process. And for us, opening up the doors to the community, on one hand, as I said, it serves the artist, but the people who come also have an amazing experience. And so the audience gets to see what that looks like at the early phases and the labor of love that it takes for these artists to come up with this stuff. And I think that what we're doing at NACL is creating a community that really is, over time, has come to understand and appreciate the work, the creative labors of the theater artist.
My next question was going to be, how is the audience response to that? Because they come with their own expectations, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of audiences come with expecting to be entertained, expecting a certain performance, if you will.
Yeah.
You're really almost removing the word performance from the performances from your theater.
Yeah, we don't call them performances. Yeah, okay. We call them
sharing. Yeah. So it's a very interesting concept. How does the audience react to that?
It's so different every week. Sometimes you're going to have the best experience you've ever had in your life. and sometimes you're just going to say, oh, geez, I didn't really get that. And before every show, I make an announcement. And I talk to everybody who's there in case they don't know what it is they're getting into. I really explain, okay, this is what we're doing here.
Okay.
And we may stop every 15 minutes and ask questions or ask you to write some things down. And then we'll continue in a different part of the theater watching a different scene. And there are lots of ways that these things happen. And we always have soup at the end. And we share the soup with the audience. It's always free. And it's a way for the artist and the audience to get to know each other, to hear about the work, but also just to get to know each other socially. And so it always feels like a really nice experience anyway. And we are really interested in cultivating relationships and conversation.
I want to go now to your periodic table.
Back in the late 90s, as I mentioned, we were a company. We hadn't moved up to Sullivan County yet. And we had a newsletter. And we called it the Periodic Table because NaCl, in addition to being North American Cultural Laboratory, is also sodium chloride, which is common table salt. When Tanis and I were first talking about, hey, what are we going to call our company?
Salt.
Like it just happened. Oh, let's call it North American Cultural Laboratory Salt. And so the Periodic Table occurred to us as a great title for our newsletter because it came out periodically. The newsletter, the Periodic Table, was originally about performances we were creating, but it was also theater artists would contribute to it and write little articles about their ideas about theater and craft and all of that. And so right now our online journal is a Periodic Table and it is also our membership platform. So it's like a way for people to give a little bit each month to us to help keep us alive. When you give money to NaCl, it's actually going directly to these artists and providing them with time, space, and money in order to create their own work. So we're in that way a little bit like a foundation.
Tell us how people would do that.
It's the website is nacl.org and the donation button is really easy to find. You can write us a check and send it to us in the mail.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of your other programs.
Great.
We also have the Birding for Beginners that's coming up soon too in July. Now that's something that folks who are listening can have the opportunity to go Saturday, July 19th.
But Jess Almacy is a performer that came up with a group called The Team. And she's been developing this piece for a while, and it's a really interesting group of performers and designers coming up to work on this piece that Jess has been writing called Birding for Beginners. And it's a wild ride.
We've been speaking with Brad Krumholtz, one of the visionaries and co-founders of NaCl. I want to thank you very much for being on Curtain Call today. It's been a true pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
And that was just part of our conversation with Brad Krumholtz from the extraordinary work that's happening over at NaCl. And by the way, don't miss their Birding for Beginners with Jessica Almacy. That's coming up Saturday, July 19th over at their facility at 110 Highland Lake Road over in Highland Lake, New York. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and go to a segment which I call the Roving Thespian. I headed over this weekend to River Rep Theater's production of The Neverending Story. I went to opening night on Saturday, had a really great time, and had the opportunity after the show to speak with a couple of kids, both who were in the audience and one child who was actually in the show itself. Here's a little bit of the behind-the-scenes look at that. What are your names?
I'm Izzy.
Izzy. And your name?
Elodie.
Melody?
Elodie.
Izzy, Elodie, Ed?
Veronica.
Veronica. Girls, what did you girls think of the show?
I thought it was really good. I thought it was amazing.
Do you know somebody in the show?
Yeah, yes. We know Waverly. She was
a baby buffalo,
and basically the younger kid, but played as like the
daughter reverse.
The mother and daughter reversed, exactly. What was your favorite part of the show? Anyone?
I liked when the troll came in just like was saying, I'm going to kill the nothing.
That was pretty scary.
That was our teacher, actually.
That was your teacher?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was our teacher. So, it's not our, like, teacher in our class, but it's our teacher in the building.
And what is your name? I didn't get your name.
Frida.
Hey. So, what? So. There she is. Wow, the young star of the show has appeared. And everybody's so excited. Waverly, my name is Tom. I'm from Radio Catskill. Just wanted to say hello.
Hi.
Did you have fun doing the show today?
Definitely.
You were excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
Very beautiful. What was your favorite part of doing it?
I think seeing how it all came together in the end.
Okay. And you worked with some pretty incredible people, right?
Yes.
You know Ellie J,
Arthur Leacy, Jess Beveridge, and a whole bunch of other people. You got to work with some real professionals. What do you think of that?
I thought it was amazing that I landed this role. It's just so thrilling to see it all come together.
Is this your first time with River Rep?
Yes, it is.
You plan on doing more shows?
Definitely.
And I heard there's a possibility that they want to tour this show. Would you go on tour with the show if they did that?
Yes.
What do you girls think? Do you think that this show could go to schools all over?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah?
Definitely, yeah.
You think other kids would enjoy it as much as you did?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. If schools knew about plays like this more, they would probably basically use it as education for, like, imagination. Because sometimes with plays, they have all these different things, like imagination. Uh-huh. Like, different plays are based on different things.
Exactly, and this play has a lot to do with imagination, doesn't it? Okay, well, thank you girls very much for being on Curtain Call.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And those kids were truly having a good time, as were the adults. We all had a lot of fun watching the never-ending story. And you, too, can catch a performance this coming weekend, Saturday the 28th at 7 p.m. and Sunday the 29th, the final performance at 2 p.m. And that's the never-ending story by the River Rep Theater. And it's over at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington, New York. So do make it a point to bring yourself out there and get the kids, get the grandchildren, and everyone will have a good time.
That is Tom Candela from Curtain Call, our new podcast about local theater. You can catch every episode and new episodes every Friday at our website, wjffradio.org. Now, at this year's Catskill Arts Space Celebration of Pride, Sarah East Johnson, founder and artistic director of the Brooklyn-based feminist acrobat dance company Lava, brings Intimacy Creates, a new performance exploring trust, vulnerability, and physical connection. Radio Catskill culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Johnson and Barbara Gogan and Ashley Brockington, co-collaborators of Intimacy Creates.
I have Barbara, Sarah, and Ashley here on the line. They're all part of an event coming up as part of Catskill Arts Space Pride. It's in its fifth year, and this year, Lava will be presenting Intimacy Creates. And we're going to talk about that event as well as a little bit about the history of Lava. So first of all, Sarah, you are the founder of Lava.
Yes, in 2000, I started the dance company.
And you performed at NACL a number of years ago.
Yeah, Lava did many residencies at NACL. We worked on shows there and then presented them to the community.
You were based in Brooklyn, and now you're based right in downtown Calicoon.
Yes, I moved to Yulin in 2017, and then I put up studio in Calicoon in 2018. So this is my home base now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it here.
And can you briefly tell us what Lava is and how you got the name?
Lava is a feminist acrobatic dance company. And I chose the name because I'm passionate about geology and the land. It's very inspiring to me. How it can be creating new earth and creating life, and how all of life really depends on rocks and soil. And the term lava is, you know, it's rock that moves. It's rock that is generative and creating new land. So I chose that as the name for the company.
You are creating new forms of dance.
Yes. In the early years when we were based in Brooklyn, it was really focused on bringing together experimental movement and traditional acrobatics. And now in 2025, the focus of the company has really shifted to not just being about feminism, but also being about race politics and larger kind of social constructs of power and oppression, and how we can use our art and our movement practices to imagine ways of liberating ourselves.
Let's move on now to Barbara. Barbara, what is your involvement with this upcoming event?
I make sounds and ambient music. I come from a kind of punk rock new wave background in England when I was young, and then I moved more into going around recording frogs and animals and integrating them into a sonic landscape. It's interesting you brought up the NACL, because in fact that is how Sarah and I met, because I was doing a performance with Brett Kaiser, the actor and playwright, down at the NACL, and Sarah was there. And so Sarah invited me to come and play music and compose music for Lava. So I did that for a number of years, and then the pandemic kind of put a stop to big performances. And Sarah and I got in the studio in Calicoon during the pandemic and started, you know, creating all these different sounds together with voices and, you know, different. I use guitar a lot to create the music. And then now here we are collaborating on this lovely, lovely project. And, you know, one of the things as a musician, to be able to play music for dancers is an extraordinary gift. I can't even describe how wonderful it feels to be playing and to have these incredible movers right in front of you and in you, and your music is inside them and their movement is inside you. So the experience is magnificent.
It's wonderful that you have found such a deep appreciation of what you're doing. Ashley, tell us a bit about your involvement in this event.
So I'm one of the intimacies. And then also Sarah asked me to lend my kind of directorial opinion as we build to kind of help shape the event.
Bonnie, one of you can respond to this. What is the theme of Intimacy Creates?
This is Sarah. I just also wanted to add that Ashley's involvement in this production, she's bringing this theatrical lens that I work in movement, which I tend towards things being more abstract and metaphorical. And Ashley's really bringing the harder questions of what are we saying? What's our intention? What does it mean? How are we communicating that? And bringing a real theatrical mind to what to the collaboration. And I kind of think more in dance terms. So that's been a really rich contribution that Ashley's made. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you, Sarah.
The project Intimacy Creates started with me asking people that I have creative partnerships with or creative relationships with, as well as personal relationships. So these are people in my life that I feel a closeness with, and we're starting with that personal closeness and building a collaboration from there. So everything that we perform on Saturday was created in a deep collaboration by the people performing it. So I didn't come in with a idea of choreography. We're going to start here and do this movement and then that movement and end here. I came in with a question for each of the artists involved. What's exciting to you right now? What's interesting to you? How do we want to dive into this? And it really, it grew and flourished from there, from the uniqueness of each artistic voice involved in the project.
There is something wonderful about collaboration.
Ooh, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time, because I'm sure you're all very busy right now preparing. Thank
Valerie,
you.
Thank you so much. Also, the event is free, so but come early because we think it might be crowded, but it's free.
Okay, thank you again.
Thanks, Valerie. Yeah, thanks Valerie.
And thanks to Valerie for that report. And thanks to you for joining us today and all week. And a reminder, you can catch previous episodes of this broadcast and all of our locally produced programming at our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, sign up for our free newsletter, which comes to your inbox every Friday morning, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org. And from listeners like you.
The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats, as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving disinformation to fill the void. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction by building bridges and holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give what you can at WJFFradio.org.
This week on Science Friday, the science of how GLP-1 medications like Ozempic and Wegovy actually work, plus the story of a medical breakthrough many years in the making, how a baby got the world's first personalized gene editing treatment.
One of my biggest fears in this whole process has been giving false hope, and so I wanted to be honest about all the things that could go wrong.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. A thick cloud cover and cool with a shower in spots today, a high 66. Tonight, overcast with a stray shower possible, low 59. For the weekend, Saturday, humid with some heavy early evening thunderstorms possible, 79 for a high. But for Sunday, partly sunny and 80.